Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to introduce Maaike Richter, who will give a talk about scarcity is entering the net. Well, there are some things to tell about scarcity. We all know oil is running out and it's limited supply. On the other hand, there are artificial scarcities. There is no reason why information would be scarce, because it can be easily copied and easily transported. And well, I think that's a bit of the gist that Maaike Richter will tell us tonight. Enjoy her speech. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome once more. So yes, I'm going to talk about digital sustainability today, but before I do that, I want to introduce myself. So I work as a journalist, and I sometimes lecture at university, and I focus on internet culture and on political aspects of the internet. Okay, and today I want to talk about digital sustainability. And at first it sounds really weird to hear the term sustainability when, you know, talking of digital things and of the internet, because sustainability, the whole concept, the whole framework of it, is very much tied to the analog world, to the meat space, and keywords here, environment and environment protection. And the bottom line is always, when people talk of sustainability, that, you know, we have to take care of our resources because they are endless. And on the contrary, on the internet, we do have something like paradise-like circumstances or paradise-like characteristics, because by default on the internet we have absence of scarcity, because information grows by sharing and you just cannot use it up. And I've been asked three times what sustainability means, so I just want to say the German word, so maybe some other guys don't know. So that simply means Nachhaltigkeit, and scarcity means Knappheit. Okay, so and the main argument of my lecture is that although we can say maybe that in the original internet, we did have this paradise-like circumstances that information grows by sharing. And my main argument here is that there are certain legal, political, and technical parameters which reduce information flow. And so we do need a framework or concepts of for concepts of sustainability for the net as well. So what can you expect from the next half an hour? So we'll talk about concepts of sustainability on and offline, and then I will present the threats, you know, the powers which are starting to introduce scarcity to the net. And we have here intellectual property rights, and then the sole cease and desist mania, and I will talk of the principle of net neutrality, what that is, and that it's being undermined. Another important issue are security measures, and then I will very briefly talk about the difficulties when you try to preserve information. If you have questions of understanding, feel free to ask, but let's do the discussion of the whole issue after the lecture. Okay, so there's this big myth, a very beautiful myth as well, and I'm sure everyone in the room has heard of it, and maybe some of you guys still believe it. And the myth goes like this, that on the internet there's space for everybody, for every activity, and for every opinion. So, but the sad truth is that the informational sphere is massively under attack, and that the era of information overflow is definitely coming to an end. Okay, so what does sustainability really mean? So that's a term that, you know, comes from the industrial age. It comes from the offline world, because the poor and sad offline world has to deal with this feature of scarcity. So what I mean with this is that whatever good you take, you know, be it oil or be it food or wood or whatever material good, there's always too little of it for everyone. So, and this is why a fair distribution of the material goods, of material resources, is just an impossible dream. And even worse, the exploitation of this material resources is harming our environment and is destroying the planet. So what does sustainability really mean? There are tons and tons of definitions of it, but two of the most popular ones go like this, that we shouldn't consume more than can be regenerated, so what, you know, can be grown after, and that people should preserve their environment and their resources, not only for themselves, but as well for future generations. But we are already nose deep in the famous information age, or we as well can call it network society or information society or knowledge society. They all kind of mean the same. And this is that it's not anymore material resources anymore, which are sources of wealth and power, but it's information and knowledge. And so they are the oil of the 21st century, we can say, and information has become a much, much contested trade commodity. And my argument is that exactly how the exploitation of oil, for example, is destroying whole landscapes, or like, you know, too much fishing is destroying the sea, the ruthless exploitation of the resource information is as well harming our online environment and the privatization of information. But like every school kid knows about sustainability in the analog world and knows what it's all about, but really there's an absence of a political framework or an absence for most people. They just don't think of that we do have to come up with some frameworks in order how to preserve the digital world. And this is especially kind of strange because we shift our lives more and more onto the online world. So I do think it's a very big mistake that there's an absence of ideas and absence of political frameworks in order to protect the net, because it is pretty much in danger. So what are the dangers? I'm going to present them now. I want to start with intellectual property rights, with copyright. So copyright never really was a big issue before the internet came. That was like an issue for specialists. But then the net became a mass medium and the whole system broke down. I mean, just as the music industry, they really can tell stories of this. So why did the whole system broke down? Because with the net and with all the digital technologies around, like one file, like one music file or film file, whatever you name it, is enough to supply all internet users of the world, because free copying is simply a characteristic of the net. Like every time we use digital technologies, every time we use the net, we simply do copies. So this is the absence of a scarcity thing I talked in the beginning. And of course, this characteristic, this free copying, is threatening business models which are designed for the analog world. And their reactions of these firms is threefold. So I'm talking now mostly about media firms. And then we have like a legal layer of this reaction. So we see a massive exaggeration and strengthening of copyright law. That is a worldwide phenomenon. And then we have a technical layer. So we see the introduction of technologies like digital rights management, or some call it digital restrictions management, depends on the side you're on. And these technologies, of course, are a barrier from copying information, from copying things. And then we see a flood of lawsuits for file sharers, but as well to kind of normal users. Because my main argument here is that when you use, or like an average person who's using the internet is violating copyright law all the time, just by day-to-day action. And effects are devastating because a very strong copyright is harming free speech, and as well, you know, expression of creative practices is suppressed. I'm not really talking about this whole file sharing issue. What I'm talking about is, for example, how average people use the internet and use digital technologies. For example, when I was a kid, we kind of did collages from newspapers. But today, these kids, they sample together music and sounds, and maybe then they post it onto their websites, and then, of course, they can get into legal hassle very easily, and that can be pretty costly. And as well, creative people are as well harmed by way too strong copyright law, because when you want to do something new, you have to have access to a creative pool of other or older creative works. Like, no composer can compose something new, you know, without knowing works from the past. But if you have, like, on everything copyright and you just cannot use stuff, or you have to do rights clearings before you can publish your things, we do have a problem, because then only people can be creative who have, for example, a major record label in their back, who do have the resources in order to pay, you know, for all the lawyers' bills. So in the end, copyright law, because it's so absolutely becoming so strong, it does censor, you know, certain behavior, and it's really day-to-day behavior, how people use the net, and certain information becomes scarce. Certain information is not making it to the internet. Another aspect of intellectual property right are patents, and I only want to talk about software patents, and really briefly on the surface, just to introduce the issue. So copyright you get onto creative works, and patents you get for technical innovations. And this whole system really kind of went the wrong way when the patent agencies started to grant patent on very trivial things, not like a real innovation, but, you know, patents on ideas, on business models, for example. So today we do have the situation that it's not anymore the best innovators that succeed, but it's very often the party with the biggest budget for patent clearings. Because as there are so many patents on trivial things, it's very easy that you do violate a patent of another party. So there are these very famous trivial patents. So Amazon is having some weirdo one, for example. There's a patent on when you buy in an online store something and then you send it to someone as a present. So they do have a patent on this. On everyone else who's having an online shop and is putting this feature into his own online shop is actually violating this Amazon patent. They already had one of the one-click payment, you know, this feature where you just can have a book and then go one-click Bestellung, I just forgot the English word. They did have a patent on this, but they're losing this patent right now. So what's the problem with these, you know, very strong intellectual property rights concerning the issue of patents? Well, software is the language of the information age, so everything is code. And if there are only very few people are able to really speak this language, because only very few people do have the resources, you know, to always pay for the patent clearings, we do have a problem, and of course, certain innovations or certain software is not making it to the internet. To sum this part about intellectual property rights up, so famous Larry Lessig has put it into some, you know, nice words. So Larry Lessig is a American law professor and very known you know, fighter for free speech, and he says that we are moving to something like we can call a permission culture. So every time you want to do something on the net, you kind of have to ask, oh, am I violating someone's copyright laws or am I violating someone's patent laws? And if the answer is, well, yes, you do violate my copyright or my patent, then, you know, people just cannot start to be active. And in the end, certain innovations or things or ideas just don't make it to the net. And the effect is, you know, we have less nice applications and things and ideas and creative works on the internet. Okay, then we have the whole cease and desist mania. One question, can you hear me loud and clear? Yeah. Fine, okay. So, I mean, blogs and the internet as a whole is seen as a very a great tool for democratization and a very neat tool for public debate. And, well, this maybe, or this might have been true, but this kind of stopped, you know, when other kind of discovered this whole, you can very easily stop or press public discussions about critical issues by sending cease and desist letters. And on the slide we see Stefan Negemeyer, and he's one of the best German journalists, and he's also a blogger. And right now he's, for example, writing a lot about the kind of, let's say, weird business models of call-in TV shows, you know, where you, when you have a show on TV and then you call and maybe you can win something, but it's more likely that not. And so he has problem of just, you know, writing about this issue because he's getting so many cease and desist letters. And this is then, of course, a very neat way in order to suppress a discussion about it. Now I'm getting to a technical issue, the end-to-end argument. That sounds kind of dry, but it's a very, very beautiful feature of the net. Maybe you guys already have asked yourself, so how do all these neat applications enter the net? You know, be it whatever, voice over IP or peer-to-peer, BitTorrent, or the early things like email or chat. Well, this all entered the net because of its very open design principle, and it's called end-to-end. And to make it really short, this end-to-end argument means that all the intelligence on the net is situated at the end host, so like on my laptop or on servers. And the network itself is not doing anything else than just, you know, forwarding innovation. That was, forwarding data packages. So in the original internet, we have to talk of the original internet, it just couldn't look up into the data packages and see what is this or where does it come from. It just was really dumb and just, you know, forwarded all the data packages. And this is why we have so many innovation on the internet, because, for example, Sean Fanning, the first guy who did a peer-to-peer network, he didn't have to ask anyone, hey, I have this cool innovation, can I please put it onto the internet? So he just did it, and then other people put it onto their computers, and the whole thing worked. And this is why the power of the net comes from its borders. So Sean Fanning, for example, from Napster, he did not have to ask the owners of the network, please, can I implement this? He just did it. He didn't have to ask anyone. But times are changing, and now we have this issue of net neutrality on the agenda, and I'm pretty sure that this issue will be like one of the most important issues in the next years. So what does it mean? It simply means the equal treatment of data traffic, so independent of source or service or broadband consumption. And then we do have gatekeepers, for example, the big telecommunication companies, so the guys who own the networks or as well internet service providers, they would love to have a say. They want to be asked when someone, for example, is putting a new application to the internet. For example, voice over IP. This is, you know, a business or telephony over the internet that is, of course, interfering with the basic discipline of telecommunication companies. And there have been cases, for example, Vonage is a voice over IP service in the United States. And in 2004, the service of Vonage was kind of, you know, slowed down by the telecommunication owners. So this whole net neutrality thing is not something academic. There are already cases where the owners of networks or other gatekeepers do use their power because this end-to-end kind of stopped. So now we do have a lot of intelligence in the network itself. It became kind of smart, and it do can look into data packages, and it do can discriminate certain applications or certain information. And there's one American law professor, lots of American law professors here in this lecture. His name is Tim Wu, and he calls the end of net neutrality and this whole discrimination of certain data traffic a Tony Soprano model. So like it's like a mafia-like, because they want to kind of have a say in things, and they want to tell people, for example, okay, you want to do voice over IP on my network, okay, but then you have to pay me extra. Or they maybe say, oh, you want to do BitTorrent? Well, you know, that's so many broadband consumption. Maybe you can do it, but then you have to pay me extra, for example. There's like a nice German word for it. It's Wegelagerei. I find it kind of matching for this. So what's the problem when net neutrality is about to stop? Well, of course, certain innovation becomes scarce. So just think of the inventors of BitTorrent, for example, if they do have to ask first the owners of the network, hey, I have something like BitTorrent, can I please, you know, put it onto the internet? And of course, answers will very often be a no or a yes, but you have to pay me extra. And of course, most people just cannot do it. Another issue is that certain content becomes scarce, so critical content. Because if a network owners are able to look into data packages, and of course, if the possibility is there in order to stop certain information flow, whatever political information, of course, this chance, you know, will be taken, and certain content or certain information will be having trouble in order to get through. And in the end, it all means. In the end of a free information flow, let's say it's that certain information will have trouble getting through. Next big issue are security measurements. I as well only want to talk briefly about it because at this Congress are lots of lecturers who deal with this whole security weirdo things which are happening right now. Well, good news, at least if you're a police officer, the internet is much, much easier to control than the meat space. Of course, it is impossible to put a police officer into every family in order to monitor whom they are meeting and whom they are calling. But this is pretty easy to do with the digital technologies. It's way easier to do that on the net. So we have the issue of data retention in Germany, but that's as well an issue in other countries as well. Data retention means Vorratsdatenspeicherung. And so data retention makes possible the storage of internet traffic, telephony, and email. So it's like a huge project of mass surveillance, and the people who this surveillance are then, for them it's then possible to identify relationships, business contacts, and of course they do can, you know, analyze this and get hints of the interests of people. as well have the issue of the Bundestrojaner, but I just want to mention it. I want to talk about it. There are so many more security measures which are entering the debate. And I always have to think of what people or what science fiction authors, kind of imagined themselves. This is right now already coming true. For example, maybe some of you guys know the movie Minority Report. That was like a major Hollywood movie a couple of years ago with Tom Cruise, but it's based on a novel by Philip K. Dick, and he wrote it in the 1950s. And there he imagined, something that a police force can monitor thoughts, and before something bad happens, then they step in and do stuff. And with this whole data retention thing, I think it's pretty much the same, and Bundestrojaner as well. So you can monitor what people do at the net, and of course, then you have the hints what these people are maybe just thinking, or if they, just want to look up, for example, how, just of interest, how bombs are built, and if you do are unlucky, and then you get into the focus of police, we do have something like a thought control, but of course, it doesn't mean that people really want to build a bomb, so maybe they just want to look it up. And the effects of this massive surveillance measurements are that, of course, everyone who's active on the internet, for example, bloggers, so they might are shy or they just don't dare to write about certain issues because they always have in the back of their heads, well, maybe if I write something about, terror, then my data record will start to look suspicious. And no, I'm not going to write about this and this and this issue because then maybe I will be in the focus of police, so I better stop with this. And in the end, of course, certain political engagement will stay out of the net, and self-censorship is one of the effects that will happen. And I'm not talking of radical engagement, I just talk about normal, nice, neat, democratic engagement. I mean, just think of what happened to André Heinz and his family, and his partner just did a very impressive and disturbing talk of what happened to them. Next issue is preservation of information. So the internet, could be a dream come true, so it could be like an endless source of every information people ever wrote, of like every artificial work or creative work, but it's very hard actually to preserve information. So then we have, for example, DRM, and if you have on creative works, some DRM technology, it's really hard to look these things up in a couple of years. For example, so if these, whatever, the service or if the hardware gets old or like no one else maintains these systems, then it's just kind of impossible to look them up in a couple of years. And of course, we do have the big problem of proprietary standards and formats. I mean, just think of people who wrote their PhD 10 years ago, and if you want to look it up today, it's pretty hard. And the effect is here that lots of digital knowledge is getting lost very, very fast. So we have this huge paradox here that, the internet could be or could function as our outsourced brain, or it could be this endless source of information and artificial works. But then we do have these forces of outbalanced intellectual property rights, we have the sole cease and desist mania, we have the problem that net neutrality is being undermined, and then we have this excessive security measures, and it all results or sums up to that, there's scarcity entering the internet as well. So it's not anymore the huge plague of humankind, or like as humankind knows it from the analog world. And this is always having very devastating effects on civil rights and freedom rights. So my point here is, yes, we do need a framework for digital sustainability, and we just shouldn't only think of this, we just shouldn't apply this only to the analog world, but as well, you know, to the virtual world. And I think we should bring this issue onto political agendas, and I think we should bring this issue into academia as well, because academia concerning this issue is as well pretty silent, and it's important to bring it into people's minds. Okay, so now the question of the questions. So what kind of concept? I think we need kind of a meta concept, a concept everyone can connect to in order to use network effects. Because, of course, today, you know, there are copyright reformers, you know, fighting for a better copyright system. And, of course, we have people who are fighting for net neutrality. And of course, we have anti-surveillance activists, but these groups are pretty separated. And although, you know, their living environment is the net. So there is like a very connecting thing they have in common, because they all kind of are active in one medium. But activists are pretty much separated. And then I want to talk briefly about a very smart text. It's called Environmentalism for the Net, and it's written by James Boyle, another American law professor. And he wrote this text 11 years ago, and it's only about intellectual property rights. And he criticized in this text a lot that the intellectual property rights system kind of got hijacked by big media companies. And his concern was that we have to protect the public domain. So public domain in Germany is something like gemeinfreie Werke, so works where copyright has run out. And in this text, he suggested that copyright reformer or intellectual property rights reformer should take the environmental movement as a role model, because they managed to achieve something pretty smart, and this is the introduction of the concept of environment. So how do I explain that? It's like in the 50s of the last century, there were like some people starting to worry about whatever, dirty water or polluted air, and then there were people concerned with protection of animal rights, but they were as well very separating, or they were like fighting for their causes very separated, until they managed to come up with the concept of the environment as a whole, and that there's a connection between polluted air and polluted water and, you know, whatever, dying of fish species. And so this was then a kind of an overall concept everyone could connect to, and or everyone could identify with, because, of course, everyone is living in an environment. So that was a pretty good concept, you know, to get into people's minds. And it kind of made the whole movement stronger. So I myself, I work with the term of sustainability, digital sustainability. So why did I do that? Well, I think it's a good term to hack media, because everyone knows the term sustainability from this whole offline discussion. And I think this term opens doors. Because every school kid knows that oil is endless, but not everyone knows that the internet does not function by itself, and not everyone knows that the internet do need like a kind of a political concept or framework in order to protect what is so beautiful about it and so useful as well. Very quickly, so what can you do, or what can everyone do in order to protect the net and to keep it as so beautiful and cool how it is with all its great applications in it? Well, it's, if you are creative, if you do stuff, it's a good idea to put these works into the public domain or to use Creative Commons licenses. Shall I talk about what Creative Commons is? Okay, very, very shortly, it's a licensing system. But it gives creators and as well users of these creative works, you know, it enables a more flexible handling of rights, so that's pretty nice. Okay, using free software, open source software is as well a very nice idea. And of course, all in all, it's nice to think, oh, wow, stuff like data retention is such a bad idea, we should do something about it. Well, it's always the much better idea than to get active, for example, and, you know, just being active in whatever anti-surveillance issues or start to be active in a copyright reformer group, stuff like this. And all in all, it's always good to know your rights and fight for them. Okay, thank you. I'm done.
Okay. Thank you. And are there any questions? And if you raise your hand.
Thank you for your talk. One of the things you mentioned is patents. I often talk to people about patents. I think you've been preaching to the converted here. I think we all agree with the things you've said, but I think we can only change these things by spreading these ideas further.
Yes.
When I talk to people about patents, they explain to me that without patents, the chemical industry wouldn't work, the pharmaceutical industry wouldn't work, that the automobile industry wouldn't work, that engineering wouldn't work. Patents are absolutely necessary, and without patents, nothing would work. So patents are a good thing, and they can only be considered as such. Similarly with privacy, I have nothing to hide. That's the answer you get. How do you counter such arguments? I've tried various things, mm-hmm. but it's a long-winded explanation. Do you have some catchy answers to these questions?
Well, you mentioned a very important thing, because what I always as well notice is it's so, you really have to have some special knowledge in order really to understand these things. And it's so complicated because copyright system, patent system, or, you know, net neutrality, before you have explained this, it's not so easy to understand. And I think that everyone, you know, internet, let's call them like internet activists, they have this very disadvantage. For example, like everyone understands that, for example, killing these cute whales is a very bad thing, and it looks so ugly when they are like lying there in their blood. So that's pretty easy. So it's very easy to mobilize people against these things. But the internet is not bleeding, and it's not very looking very cute, so it's hard to activate people. And I think how you can get them is when you really have examples where things really got wrong. So, and I think it's not a good idea to talk very abstract about this bad patent system, but when you, for example, you know, take these examples of these very weird patents which exist, I think that helps.
Do you?
It doesn't? Are there any more questions?
Do you really believe that there will be a scarcity instead of a segregation? Because it seems like the resource that you are measuring is human creativity, which won't become depleted. But because people can set their own rules on the internet, such as choosing Creative Commons over a more restrictive license, Do you believe that there will be a scarcity versus a segregation of the internet into free and not free parts?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
Do you think that there will be a segregation of the internet between free and non-free parts?
Instead of a scarcity.
Yeah, I think this can happen as well, but I wouldn't say instead of scarcity. But I mean, if you have, you know, some privileged elite which is having access to everything and the others do not have this, I think you have something like scarcity. My ears really start to hurt of this technique here.
First of all, thanks for the talk for me as well. Just a short remark. It's not as if it isn't a problem with, as if there wasn't a problem with pharmaceutical patents. I'm working a lot on drug prices, and you actually can see many people dying because of too high drug prices. But coming to the main point I wanted to make, you're introducing the term of sustainability, digital
yes.
sustainability. I'm a little bit doubtful whether this makes too much sense, so maybe you could define it better, elaborate on it. What's the definition of that? Because for me, it has two problems, the term sustainability. One is that it comes from a language, from a field of scarcity. I mean, the whole environmental debate is one about scarcity. That's where the term comes from, that's where Daly invented it, and so on and so forth. And the second one is, in the environmental debate, we saw very easily how that term could be hijacked by the forces of evil. You hear things like sustainable growth by big chemical companies. Mm-hmm. And I could imagine one important point, if I were be on the other side, important points to keep digital sustainability is to keep the internet free of filth, to keep enough incentives, and to prevent the internet from clogging. This all could also be summed up mm-hmm. under sustainability. So is there a way to make it more sustainable, more specific? Otherwise, I see a really nice term on your web address. I could imagine talking more about the commons. Is another unifying term that would be less easy to capture and hijack.
Well, I think commons is a nice term as well, and of course there's people who deal with this term, and they choose commons, and they did not choose sustainability. So I just took this one, as I said in the one of the last slides, because I think people can connect to this term because they know it from the offline world, and. Really, people, I mean, the message really got through, I think, to everyone that we have to protect our environment, and this is very much tied to the term sustainability. But there are so many people who still think, no, the internet is free and open for everyone, and it's paradise and what else, and it's like kind of, it's just not having these problems. And then you said, so maybe it can happen that this term can be kind of hijacked so that firms say, well, we do sustainable development. Well, of course, I mean, this can always happen. I mean, the counterparts will always find some rhetorical turnarounds in order to kind of mess up your message. Of course, that can happen. Like, my main idea was, it's just really like, when I talk to people who know what's going on, so like people who go to CCC congresses, of course they know really, yes, we have a problem with copyright, yes, we have a problem with net neutrality, yes, we have a big problem with the security measurements, but if you just step out of these people who already know about these issues, people really do say things like, well, why not monitor data traffic because I don't have anything to hide? So people like outside of the, let's say the people who know what's going on, it's, I think we do need tools in order to reach them because for them that's just not an issue.
I think it's even worse than you said because I think We are even losing the freedoms in the analog world we had, we used to have, because the copyright holders are much more eager today now to close all gaps in which content can escape. I even read an article that children in the UK were forbidden to sing Christmas songs because they were not they were copyrighted. That's something I think that would not have happened a few years ago.
Okay, I have a microphone. Okay, I would like to give an example for the question of the for the fellow at the wall with the division of the net in free and non-free parts, I think. I believe in some areas the only possible division would be into a legal and illegal part. For example, as Michael described, the patent system, which is kind of out of control regarding software. It also is a problem for free software. Free software authors can't do these patent clearings and research if their software violates patents and the patents get more all the time and so on. So there will, given a specific legal climate, there will just be no possibility of putting free software on the net. So there will be a scarcity, or you will put it online illegal and anonymously, but you can't have a free part of the net if the laws forbid it.
Boundaries, legal boundaries on the net are not limited by geographical borders anymore. Because if you say this is illegal in this country, then what happens if it is illegal to use a hacking tool in Germany, but a German downloads it while in South America from a server in Egypt? Like completely outside of the legal jurisdictions of that particular area, you can't easily pin down laws to things that have no location.
I think that's very optimistic, but I don't think we need to have a big discussion here.
Do that in the bar. Do you want to, Michael, do you want to answer or shall I do the next question?
My comment.
Well, I sometimes wonder whether the mainstream opinion here that intellectual property, patent law, and all that is starting to clog up the internet and stop progress from being made there is maybe too pessimistic, that maybe something else is the case, that these changes that are required for other industries to adapt to the internet are taking place not at the internet speed, but at society speed, which is still much slower. So basically we're screwing one industry at a time. We've basically done the music industry. The movies are kind of following now. And many, many other industries, like for example, I've seen figures about the pharmacy industry that has like 94% overhead in reproducing stuff, copycat drugs that are being produced just because the other stuff is, has got copyright pending. And we're seeing nations like China who don't really obey copyright law and who are therefore much more productive. So I think I sometimes wonder whether maybe these systems that are in place right now and that are based on analog production and IP regulations or thoughts at least will turn out to be so ineffective that they, although they are right now being supported and further supported by the law that is being made, will turn out to be so ineffective that they will just crumble at some point, and that might be in a couple of years, it might be in a couple of decades, but that will happen. I don't know.
I just take it as a nice comment, or do you have a question with this?
No. Are people with real questions for Maike?
Well, it's another comment. I would like to comment on the notion of scarcity in like real life, like physical world around us, because I think that we also have a case of gatekeeping here and some areas where we have a where we are in a situation where a lot of people are dying of hunger, but we actually don't have a scarcity of food. We are actually producing way more food than we would.
We don't have what? A scarcity of?
Food.
Uh-huh.
we are producing way more food than we would need to feed the world, but we're dumping a lot in litter or whatever, we're destroying it so we can keep the prices up. So I think this division between scarcity in physical, real life and in the digital world is questionable as well. I think some of the thoughts have come up in the digital world, like who are the gatekeepers who make things scarce, can also be implied on the like real world. And the same is true on the other way around as well. We do have some very strict like real world limitations on the internet that create scarcity there. Like we have a very non-balanced distribution of computers on this planet. We are talking from a very white, rich European point of view here. And I think that's an effect of scarcity as well, that we have like, I don't know, a very small percentage of the world population with the possibility of accessing this knowledge. So that's
yeah, of course, we still have a huge digital divide. I just want to make clear, I mean, it's not about scarcity, and it's not about that we cannot, you know, have access to certain, whatever, texts or creative works. It's always having this whole copyright issue, for example, it's having very harsh effects on civil rights, yes? I mean, it's not about consume, for example. And as well, think that this big separation between analog world and digital world already has ceased years ago, at least for people, you know, in the Western societies.
Yeah, two comments or maybe questions. I really like your idea that we must try to bring the different kind of movements much more together, the anti-copyright movement, the privacy movement, and so on. But I'm not really sure how... I'm from the privacy movement. I'm not really sure how I can tell people that they have something to hide by talking about scarcity and sustainability. It just doesn't connect at the first sight. I want personal data to be a scarce resource.
You want what?
I want personal data, data about myself, to be a very scarce resource that nobody can access without my knowledge and my agreement, you know. So I wonder if a kind of a different term could be a bit more unifying. In the context of the World Summit on the Information Society a few years ago, a lot of international civil society groups came up with the concept of communication rights. You know, that links the right to also copy and to have fair use and stuff like that with privacy rights and so on, and other rights to free speech and so on. It was also a bit difficult because some traditional human rights people disagreed with that and so on, but I also find it more strong in the end, because if you argue for sustainability, you basically say, yeah, there is this goal that we need to have a sustainable environment and sustainable policies and technologies and so on. So it's somewhere in the future and we have to get there. But if we talk about rights, we can say, it's my damn right and I have it. It's in our constitution and, you know, it's a bit stronger, I would even say.
I mean, that's always the thing with terms, you know. It always depends on with what kind of meaning you fill it up. And my main point here in this lecture was, well, first, I think we do need some kind of theory, right? Because that is just not really an issue. And I think it's a very poor record for academia that they really don't focus on these issues much. So, I mean, I come from cultural sciences and I do give lectures at university, but there are very few who talk of these issues, and I think that's a very big mistake. So I think first step is we do need to bring this somehow onto the agenda. And yes, scarcity as well. So I'm, for example, as well, very keen on my, you know, private information, and I am a blogger as well, and I never ever put any personal information into my blog. I only write about copyright things and free software things, but never personal. So, I mean, and that's not for me a contrast when I talk of scarcity, because, I mean, in this frame, I mean, this is like a 30-minute lecture, and of course I cannot be so accurate with terms and with the meaning. So my point here really is I think it's important just to bring these issues up, and that academia starts with you know, focusing on this, and with focusing on our online environment as a whole.
I'm from academia too, and I absolutely agree with your saying we need more theoretical conceptual work on this. But can you tell me in one sentence how privacy and sustainability or being against scarcity fit together? I just don't get it.
How privacy and sustainability fit together in one sentence? Okay, I'll try. Well, I think an internet which is having a kind of sustainable framework, so people should kind of be able to decide what kind of data they have to make public, for example, so that they are kind of that they are able to, for example, keep data diets. I'm a big fan of keeping data diets. So that, you know, people can decide for themselves, and of course that is what's not sustainable is something like data retention, because then you're not anymore the master or mistress of your data. It kind of gets hijacked by someone if you're unlucky.
Okay. The last question for this room, and I guess that there is a bar next door for another long discussion, so go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to try to give an answer to that question. I think if privacy is something that is in danger, because you're under surveillance or you fear to be open-minded and articulate what you think, then sustainability in the net is being in danger of, and information becomes scarce. What? Well, all this is about democracy and the system and all that stuff. So I think if someone argues, does that have to do together? You have to think about some kind of world you want to live in that deals with the same things, meaning your rights in the meat space, in the offline world and the online world. So I think it belongs together. If you fear to say something, or if you fear to lose your privacy, you won't feed the web anymore. And then perhaps it dies, or it just contains blockbuster movies.
Yeah. Mike, do you have an answer?
I think it was a neat comment.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's end this session and thank Maaike again for her nice speech and her answers.
Thank you.